Love You Dead by Peter James. Read by Daniel Wayman. Chapter 1. Tuesday, the 10th of February. The two lovers peered out of the hotel bedroom window, smiling with glee, but each for a very different reason. The heavy snowfall that had been forecast for almost a week had finally arrived overnight, and fat, thick flakes of the white stuff were still tumbling down this morning. A few cars, chains clanking, slithered up the narrow mountain road, and others, parked outside the hotels, were now large white mounds. Everyone in the smart French ski resort of Courchevel 1850 was relieved. The resort managers, the hoteliers, the restaurateurs, the saisonniers, the ski rental shops, the lift companies, and all the others who relied on the ski season for much of their livelihood. And, most importantly of all, the winter sporters themselves. After days of blue skies, searing sunshine and melting snow, which meant treacherous ice in the mornings and slush and exposed rocks in the afternoons, finally the skiers and snowboarders who had paid top money for their precious annual few days on the slopes now had great conditions to look forward to. As Jodie Bentley and her elderly American fiancé Walt put on their skis outside the bootroom entrance of the Shabby Shoe Hotel, the falling snow tickled exposed parts of their faces beneath their helmets and visors. Although a seasoned skier and powder hound, this was the financier's first time skiing in Europe, and he had been relying all week on his much younger fiancée, who seemed to know the resort like the back of her hand, to guide him. They skied down carefully in the poor visibility to the Biolay lift, just a couple of minutes below the hotel, went through the electronic turnstiles, and joined the short queue to the chairlift. A couple of minutes later, clutching their ski poles, the wide chair scooped them up and forward. Walt pulled down the safety bar, then they settled back, snug in their cosy outfits, for the 7 minutes it took for the lift to carry them to the top. As they alighted, the wind was blowing fiercely, and without hanging around, Jodie led the way down an easy red, then blue run to the Croisette, the central lift station for the resort. They removed their skis, and Walt, despite suffering from a prolapsed disc, insisted on carrying Jodie's skis as well as his own up the ramp to the lift. As a red 8-seater gondola came slowly round, he jammed their skis into two of the outside holders, then followed Jodie in. They sat down and pushed up their visors. They were followed by another couple, and moments later, just before the doors closed, a short man in his 50s clambered in after them, wearing a smart spider ski outfit and a flashy leather helmet with a mirrored visor.
"Bonjour," he said in a bad French accent, then added, "Hope you don't mind my joining you."
He settled down opposite them as the gondola lurched forward.
"Not at all," Walt said.
Jodie smiled politely. The other two strangers, both busy texting on their phones, said nothing.
"Ah bien, vous parlez anglais?"
The stranger unclipped his helmet and removed it for an instant to scratch the top of his bald head.
"American?"
he said, pulling off his gloves, then removing a tissue from his pocket and starting to wipe his glasses.
"I'm from California, but my fiancée's a Brit," Walt said amicably.
"Jolly good. Beastly weather, but the powder at the top should be to die for," the man said.
Jodie smiled politely again.
"Where are you from?" she asked. "The South. Brighton," the stranger replied. "Good Lord, what a coincidence, so am I," Jodie said.
"Small world," he muttered, and suddenly looked uncomfortable.
"So, what line of business are you in?" Walt asked him.
"Oh, in the medical world. Just recently retired and moved to France. And yourselves?"
"I have a group of investment trusts," the American replied.
"I was a legal secretary," Jodie said.
As the small gondola climbed, rocked by the wind, the snow was turning into a blizzard, and the visibility deteriorating by the minute. Walt put his arm round Jodie and hugged her.
"Maybe we shouldn't go too high this morning, hon. It's going to be very windy at the top," he said.
"The powder's going to be awesome up there," she replied, "and there won't be too many people this early. There are some really fabulous runs, trust me."
"Well, okay," he said, peering dubiously through the misted-up windows.
"Oh, absolutely," the Englishman said. "Trust your beautiful young lady. And the forecast is improving." As the gondola reached the first stage, he waited politely for them to alight first.
"Nice meeting you," he said. "Bye for now."
The other couple, still texting, remained on the gondola. With Walt again insisting on carrying Jody's skis, they trudged the short distance to the cable car. Normally jam-packed with skiers squashed together like sardines, this morning the huge cabin was three-quarters empty. Along with themselves, there were just a few diehards, several boarders in their baggy outfits, two rugged-looking bearded men in bobble hats wearing rucksacks who were sharing swigs from a hip flask, and a small assortment of other skiers, one wearing a GoPro camera on his helmet. Walt raised his visor and smiled at Jody. She raised hers and smiled back. He removed a glove, jamming it between his skis, produced a chocolate bar from his breast pocket, and offered it to Jody. "I'm fine, thanks. Still stuffed from breakfast."
"You hardly ate anything."
He broke a piece off, put the bar back in his pocket, and zipped it shut, then chewed, peering out anxiously. The cable car rocked in the wind, then swayed alarmingly, causing everyone to shriek, some out of fear, others for fun. He put an arm round Jody again, and she snuggled up against him.
"Maybe we should get a coffee at the top and wait to see if the visibility improves," he said.
"Let's do a couple of runs first, my love," she replied.
"We'll find some fresh powder before it gets ruined by other skiers." He shrugged.
"Okay."
But he didn't sound particularly enthusiastic. He stared at her for some moments.
"You know," he said, "you're incredible. Not many people can look beautiful in a helmet and visor, but you do."
"And you look every inch my handsome prince," she replied.
He tried to kiss her, but the top of his helmet bashed against her visor. She giggled, then leaned closer to him and whispered,
"Too bad there's other people on here,"
running her gloved hand down his crotch. He squirmed.
"Jeez, you're making me horny."
"You make me horny all the time."
He grinned. Then he looked serious again, and a tad nervous. He peered through a window into the blizzard, and the car yawed in the wind, then swung, almost throwing him off balance.
"You have your cell with you, hon?" he asked.
"Yes.
You know, just in case we lose each other in this whiteout."
"We won't," she said confidently.
He patted his chest and frowned. Patted it again, then tugged open another zipper.
"Jeez,"
he said, and began to pat all over the front of his stylish black Bognor ski jacket.
"I can't believe it, how stupid. I must have left mine back in the room."
"I'm sure I saw you put it in. Your top right-hand pocket, before we left," she said.
He checked all over again, and his trouser pockets.
"God damn it, must have fallen out somewhere. Maybe when we were putting our skis on."
"We're going to stay close. Just in case we do get separated, then plan B is we both ski back down to the Croisette and meet there. Just follow the signs for Courchevel, 1850. It's well posted all the way."
"Maybe we should ski straight back down and go and check it's not lying in the snow outside the hotel."
"Someone will find it if it is, darling. No one's going to steal it. Not at that lovely hotel."
"We'd better go back down. I need it. I have a couple of important calls to make this afternoon."
"Okay," she said. "Sure, fine. We'll ski fast."
5 minutes later, the cable car slowed right down, and a shadow loomed ahead. The car rocked from side to side, bumping against the buffered sides of the station, slowly sliding in before stopping. Then the doors opened, and they stepped out in their heavy ski boots onto the gridded metal walkway. They shuffled along it, then carefully down the steps and out into the ferocious blizzard, their faces stinging from snow as hard as hailstones. They could barely see a few feet in front of them, and the group ahead, ducking down and clipping into their boards, were little more than shadowy silhouettes. As they stood beside a sign mostly obscured with snow, Walt laid their skis down on the ground, kicked the ice away from the bottom of his boots, tapping them with his ski poles to make extra sure there were no lumps of snow stuck there, then stepped into his bindings and snapped them shut. As the silhouettes began to move away, Jody said,
"Hang on a sec, darling. I need to clean my visor."
Walt waited, turning his face away from the wind as best he could, while Jody tugged down one of her zippers, produced a tissue, and wiped the inside of her visor, then the outside.
"This is horrible,"
he had to shout to make his voice heard.
"We're almost at the highest point in the whole resort," she said.
As soon as we get off this ridge, we'll be out of the wind.
I hope you're right. Maybe we should start with something easy. Is there a blue run back down? I don't fancy anything too challenging in this goddamn visibility.
There is, and it's lovely. There's one tiny steep bit to get into it, then it'll be a glorious cruise. It's my favourite run.
He watched the last of the silhouettes disappearing as Jodie pulled her gloves back on, then stepped into her skis.
Ready?
She asked.
Uh-huh.
She pointed to the right.
We go down here.
Are you sure? Everyone else has gone that way.
He pointed in the direction that the others who had been in the cable car with them had taken.
You want the hardcore black rundown, or a gentle blue?
Blue,
he said emphatically.
That crazy lot have all taken the black.
She glanced over her shoulder and could just make out the cable car leaving the station for its return journey. It would be around 15 minutes before the next load of skiers arrived. Right now, they were alone.
Blue, she said. Are you sure? I'm sure you'd cope with the black.
Not in this visibility.
Then we go this way, she said.
I can't see any sign pointing this way, hun. There must be a signpost up here, surely.
With one ski pole, she began to brush away the fresh powder snow from the ground beside her. After a moment, tracks were revealed beneath it, frozen into the cruddy, icy surface beneath.
See?
She said. He peered at them. They led straight ahead for a couple of yards before disappearing into the swirling white blizzard. Looking relieved, he smiled.
Clever girl. I'll follow you.
No, you go first in case you fall over. I can help you up. Just follow the tracks. Bend your knees and brace yourself because the first 50 yards or so are a bit steep, then it levels out. Just let yourself go.
She shot an anxious glance around her to make absolutely sure no one was watching.
Okay,
he said with a sudden burst of enthusiasm.
Here goes. Yee-haw!
He launched himself forward on his poles like a racer out of the gate and whooped again. Yee-haw! Then his voice turned into a terrible scream just for one fleeting second, before it was swallowed by the wind. Then silence. Jodie turned round, then, pushing with her poles, headed off in the direction all the other skiers had taken, oblivious to the wind and the stinging snow on her cheeks. Chapter 2. Tuesday, the 10th of February. Jodie did what she and Walt had agreed if they lost each other, which was to ski down to the Croisette and wait in front of the entrance to the ski school. It was much warmer down here than it had been up at the top of the Solier, and just as the Englishman they'd met in the gondola had predicted, the weather was now improving. The falling snow had turned to flecks of sleet, and the sun was trying to break through. And apart from that man, no one in either of the lifts in which they had travelled to the top had taken any notice of them. She removed her helmet so that, maybe later, someone would recognise her and be able to back up her story. That guy from Brighton might even prove useful. He'd be able to verify she and Walt had both set off skiing together in the poor visibility. A shame she hadn't asked him his name. She glanced at her watch, wondering just how long would be considered a respectable waiting time. An hour, she decided. An hour would be a perfectly reasonable time before she headed into a bar for a nice warm coffee and an eau de vie schnapps, maybe a double, to take the edge off her nerves. Somewhere to sit and plan her story carefully. She pushed back her sleeve and glanced at her watch. 11:05 a.m. The day was still young, and more skiers were venturing out of their hotels and chalets now that the weather was clearing and heading into the lift stations around her. Suddenly, an idiot on a snowboard ran over her skis and grabbed hold of her, trying to prevent them both falling over.
"Awfully sorry. Pardonnez-moi."
His apology was as clumsy as his actions.
"Dickhead,"
she said, freeing herself from his clutches.
"There's no need to be rude." "Oh, right. I'm just standing here, minding my own business, and you crash into me. What do you want me to do? Dance?"
She stepped away from him, huffily, and resumed staring up at the slopes, clocking anyone in a black jacket and trousers who might, possibly, be her fiancé. Not that she was expecting to see him. But she continued watching, her story prepared just in case, however unlikely it was, he appeared. An hour and a half later, Jodie stepped out of the bar,
pulled on her fur-lined Cornelia James gloves, hoisted her skis onto her shoulder and trudged the short distance up the steep incline towards the Shabby Shoe Hotel. Above her, she heard the whocker, whocker, whocker sound of a helicopter and looked up at it. Maybe it was taking a group heli-skiing up to some off-piste powder. Or maybe it belonged to the local emergency services. Had someone found his body already? A bit sooner than she had planned. Damn the weather. She'd hoped for the whiteout to last a bit longer. But no matter. Popping a piece of mint chewing gum into her mouth to mask the smell of alcohol, she placed the skis and poles in the rack by the ski room entrance and went inside and into the ski shop. There were rows of new skis lining one wall, a rack of helmets on another, and several mannequins clad in the latest in skiing chic dotted around. The young, handsome Frenchman, who was the ski shop manager and had kitted them out with their rental skis, greeted her with a smile. In a charming French accent, Simon Place said, "You're not skiing? We have the best conditions here on the mountains in weeks, beautiful powder, and I think this afternoon the weather will be sunshine." "I've lost my fiancé. It was a whiteout at the top when we went up. I don't like skiing on my own. Stupidly left my phone in our room. I'm going to call him to try to find him. That's one problem with this resort, it's so big." As he helped her off with her boots, he asked, "You like the skis?" "Yes, they're good. Stöckli skis they are, you know, the Rolls-Royce skis." "Too bad they don't come with a chauffeur," she said, and walked out into the corridor, leaving him puzzling over the remark. She picked up her key from the hotel's reception desk, telling the receptionist she'd become separated from her fiancé out skiing and was worried because she'd waited for him at the bottom for an hour and he hadn't turned up. She added that he was an experienced skier, and she was sure he'd be fine, and asked the receptionist, when Walt eventually turned up, to tell him she'd be in the spa if she wasn't in their room. Then she took the lift up to the third floor. The room had already been cleaned. It looked neat and tidy, and there was a faint, pleasant smell of pine. She removed her phone from the back of the shelf where she had placed her underwear and dialed Walt's number, wanting to be sure that if the police were subsequently to check her phone, she had done what she had said. She heard Walt's phone buzz, and then begin warbling as well. She ended the call, removed his phone from under the pile of his clothes in the drawer where she had hidden it, and placed it on the desk beside his laptop. Then she peeled off her wet jacket, hung it over a radiator, dumped her gum into the waste bin, and sat down on the freshly plumped duvet, thinking hard. So far, so good. She felt hungry, and the large schnapps had gone to her head a little. She had a witness that she'd travelled up to the top with her fiancé. She had another witness in the ski shop that she had returned without him, having become separated in the whiteout, and that she'd gone back to the hotel to get her phone. And no witness to what had happened at the top of the Sorlier. When they had got engaged, Walt had told her that he had written her into his will. So sweet of him. There was a nice spa downstairs, with a swimming pool. She'd check her emails, have some lunch in the restaurant, and check with the receptionist again. Then, if no update, she'd have a relaxing afternoon in the spa, and perhaps get a massage. Around 5:30 p.m., a good hour after the lifts had closed, she'd go back to the reception desk and reiterate her concerns about her fiancé not having returned, and ask if they could check with the police and clinics. Just like any anxious loved one might do. She was feeling pretty happy with herself. Chapter 3. Tuesday, the 10th of February. Roy Grace was feeling pretty happy with himself, too, as he slid off the physiotherapist's table in her small Brighton consulting room, and looking forward to Saturday, Valentine's Day. He'd booked a table at his and Cleo's favourite Brighton restaurant, English's, and he was already thinking with anticipation about what he was going to have. Oysters Kilpatrick, grilled with bacon, and then either lobster or a Dover sole with mushy peas. A glass of champagne to start with, and then a nice bottle of their Puy Fuissé white burgundy, his favourite wine, when he could afford it. Buying their new house, a cottage in the country on the outskirts of Henfield, had stretched them both financially, but they'd still kept a small amount aside for spoiling each other on special occasions, and this was one. They'd already had a great housewarming party with family and friends, and he was delighted that his sister was becoming close friends with Cleo's sister, Charlie.
His first wife, Sandy, had had no siblings, and relations with her odd parents had always been strained at best. So this was really nice to see.
"That's it," Anita Lane said. "We're done. I don't think I need to see you again, unless your leg starts giving you any grief, in which case call me."
"Thanks," he said. "Brilliant." He'd been coming here twice a week since early January, after a surgeon at the Royal Sussex County Hospital had removed 11 shotgun pellets from his right leg just before Christmas. He had been shot at close range by a suspected serial killer he'd been attempting to arrest in a bunker beneath a house in Hove. The surgeon had breezily told him he'd been very lucky not to lose his leg. To begin with, recovery had been agony, with several of the nerves damaged, and he'd woken many times during the nights that followed with the sensation that his leg was on fire. But he'd stuck rigidly to the exercise program the physio had given him in between their sessions. Finally, the pain had eased, and the mobility was returning.
"Keep up the exercises for a few more weeks," she said.
"How soon can I start running again, Anita?"
"You can start now, but build it up slowly. Don't try and do a marathon, okay?"
"I won't.
If you get pain, come straight back to see me. That's an order."
"You're quite the bully, aren't you?" He grinned.
"It's because I can see you're chomping at the bit. You've had a massive trauma to that leg, and just because you've thrown your walking stick away and I'm discharging you doesn't mean you can start going mad. Comprende?"
"Comprende."
"And try not to get into any bundles with any villains for a while."
"I'm a detective superintendent. I don't get into many fights with suspects."
"Oh, right. Being a detective superintendent means you just get shot by them."
He grimaced.
"Yep. Well, hopefully not too often." "I hope not. A lot of people only get shot once, and it's not a physiotherapist they need afterwards, but an undertaker. Stay safe. Isn't that what you say?"
"I'm impressed with your police lingo."
He shook her hand, went out to the receptionist, and paid the bill, carefully sticking the receipt in his wallet. Treatment for injuries sustained whilst on duty were reimbursed out of police funds. 20 minutes later, he arrived back at his office in Sussex House, feeling a sense of an era passing. Although in part a lateral, out-of-the-box thinker, Roy Grace was at heart an extremely methodical man. The quality he had always admired and respected in those he had learned from in the past, and which he sought in anyone he selected to work with him. He was a creature of habit, and didn't like change, which he always found unsettling, and thanks to the government's swingeing budget cuts to the police, massive changes had already happened, and there were more afoot. The effect on morale was palpable. A decade ago, he could guarantee that almost everyone in the force loved their job. Now, too many people were leaving before their retirement time, fed up with the freezes on promotion, or with the alterations to their pensions foisted on them midstream in their careers, or with walking on eggshells in fear of the political correctness zealots. Being a police officer had become a job where you were afraid to speak your mind or tell a joke. Yet, Grace knew only too well from his own experience, it was precisely that gallows humour the police were so famous for that enabled officers to cope with the horrors they sometimes saw. In truth, many of the changes had helped to create more tolerant, less corrupt, less sexist, and less racist police forces than when Roy Grace had begun his career. There were many pluses. He did still love his job, and he tried not to let the negatives get to him. But there were moments, too, for the first time in the 2 decades he had served, that he had found himself contemplating alternatives, particularly during his month off in January convalescing, when he'd had time to think. In his heart, he knew nothing could ever give him the satisfaction that solving murders did, despite all the changes. And there was one very big change happening right here, to this building. Formerly the HQCID, before the merger of the major crime team with Surrey, this 2-story Art Deco building had been his base for the past decade. Once it had been a hive of activity, filled with detectives, SOCOs, a forensic department, the fingerprint imaging and high-tech crime units, and the hub for many homicide and other serious crime investigations. But in a few months, it would be no more, thanks to the brutal, and in his view highly short-sighted, government budget cuts inflicted on his and other police forces in the UK. The imaging unit had already moved to Surrey. Soon the high-tech crime unit would be moved a few miles north of Brighton to Haywards Heath, and while nothing was confirmed yet,
The rumour was that his branch of the major crime team would be moved to the Sussex Police Headquarters in Lewes. Like most of the officers and support staff here, he had never really liked this building. Stuck on an industrial estate on the edge of the city, with no canteen, far too many people crammed into it, and a heating and air conditioning system that was unable to cope in any weather conditions, he should have been glad of the impending move. But now, with the building beginning to take on the air of a ghost town, he was starting to feel nostalgic for it. All that would remain on this site by this coming autumn would be the custody block right behind it. He walked through the large, deserted, open-plan first-floor office that had until recently been the detective's room, passing the cleared desks of officers and civilian staff who had already moved elsewhere, then entered his own office, one of the few enclosed ones. He closed the door and sat behind his desk, staring out through the drizzle at the Asda superstore across the road which served as their canteen, thinking about Cleo's first Mother's Day, which was just a few weeks away. He needed to get her a present from Noah. Roy had an ongoing list on his phone of gifts to get Cleo for her birthday and for Christmas, one of which was turquoise earrings, she loved the colour, and a rollerball pen. He added book to remind himself to get down to City Books to pick up a novel she wanted, although he had forgotten the title. He would have to tease it out of her somehow. Then he logged onto his computer terminal and checked the serials and emails that had come in since he'd been at the physio, noting an email trail that referred to the Sussex Police rugby team. It reminded him he needed to find a new captain, as the current one was being sent to work on anti-terrorist training at the FBI's base in Quantico, Virginia. He was also pleased to see that the bread-making machine Cleo and he had ordered for the house was on its way. He fired off some quick responses and forwarded the rugby emails to one of his predecessors, a retired former Detective Chief Superintendent David Gaylor, who had continued to be the team manager. Next, he turned his attention back to the case that had been consuming him ever since his return to work. His assailant, Dr. Edward Crisp. He glanced at the photograph of the Hove general practitioner, who appeared to be staring back at him with a smug grin. Crisp had murdered 5 women in their early 20s, or rather, 5 that they knew about. His tally could quite possibly be higher, maybe a lot higher. They'd had him cornered in an underground lair, but after shooting Grace in the leg with a shotgun, the man had made a seemingly impossible escape. No one knew how. One theory was that Crisp, an experienced potholer and caver, had gone through the Brighton Hove sewer system and had emerged through one of the manholes in the complex network. Southern Water, who controlled it, were initially adamant that it would not have been possible for anyone to have survived. If Crisp hadn't drowned, he'd have ended up in one of the filters that prevented objects larger than a fraction of an inch reaching the open sea. Yet their searches found no trace of a body. They'd been forced to admit, reluctantly, that it was possible, however unlikely, that Crisp had survived. One thing that Roy Grace was certain of was Crisp's cunning. The man's estranged wife, Sandra, had been interviewed exhaustively and exonerated from any complicity. She seemed very happy and relieved to be away from him. The only one who appeared to be missing the doctor was the family dog, Smut, now living with her and apparently pining. Incredible though it was, for all the years that they had lived together, she had no idea that the derelict house next door to their Brighton mansion, where Crisp had carried out some, if not all, of his atrocities, had been owned by an offshore company set up by her husband. Very recently, the police had received possible evidence that Crisp had survived. It was in the form of a sinister email that the doctor had subsequently sent to one of Roy's team, some weeks after his disappearance and presumed death. The source of the email was apparently untraceable, an anonymous Hotmail account that could have come from anywhere in the world, and which, just possibly, could have been sent on a time delay weeks earlier. Fortunately, so far, February had been a calm time, with no reported homicides in Sussex, leaving Roy Grace free to work doggedly through contacts at police forces throughout Europe, the USA, Australia, Africa, and the Far East for any signs of the doctor. He had also spent some time with the desk officer at Interpol, ensuring that Crisp's details and photograph were circulated around the world. Crisp's MO was to target women in their early 20s with long brown hair. Summaries of every unsolved murder matching this profile from within the UK and overseas were stacked all around Roy and filled numerous folders on his computer. And he was still no further forward. There were around 200 countries in the world, and right now Dr. Edward Crisp could be sitting in a hotel room with his bald head and big glasses and smug grin in any one of them. Although a few, especially Syria and North Korea, could probably be safely eliminated. "So where the hell are you, you bastard?" Grace said aloud in frustration.
"Right here, oh master."
He looked up, startled, to see his mate D.I. Glenn Branson, a black, shaven-headed man-mountain, standing in front of him with a broad smile.
"You're not looking a happy bunny," Branson said.
"Yeah. You know why not? Because every time I start to feel a happy bunny, I see Edward Bloody Crisp's face grinning at me."
"Well, I've got some news for you."
"Tell me." Branson reached over and placed an email printout on Grace's desk. Grace read it, then looked up at his mate. Shit. Chapter 4. Tuesday, the 10th of February. Shortly before 6 p.m, Jody woke up with a start on the big, soft duvet in her Courchevel hotel room to the sound of a helicopter flying low and fast over the resort. She could see through the window. It was almost dark outside. Her mouth was dry, and she had a slight headache. She drank some water, went over to the desk, and flipped open the lid of her Mac laptop. She tapped in her password, then checked her emails. Immediately, she smiled. Another one from him. "My dearest Jody, I trust you're having a good time wherever in the world this finds you on your travels. For too long, you've been tantalizing me with your lovely messages. I love that very, very sexy picture you sent me yesterday. I feel a truly wonderful connection between us and cannot wait to finally meet you. When do you think that might be? I'm now settled into my glorious new beachfront house in Brighton, where I have some very lovely celebrity neighbours. Please tell me it won't be long. Fondest love, Rowley." She typed her reply. "My very sexy Rowley. I agree. Even though we've not yet met, I feel massively in touch with you too, and just love how you think. I really do. And I love how you make me feel just by reading your words. I plan to be back in Brighton just as soon as I finish my business commitments here in New York. Or, as I've been told how to pronounce it like the locals, New York! Each time I think of you, I think of a beautiful expression I once read, written by an Indian poet. The path of love is narrow, and there is not room for two people on it. So you must become one. That's how I feel about us." She signed it with a row of kisses and sent it. Then she carefully filed his email and her reply into a folder titled Charities Local, which was buried inside another folder marked Charities, just in case somehow Walt had ever found his way into her computer. Not that there had ever been much likelihood, as he wasn't particularly computer savvy. She logged off, closed the lid, and sat still for some minutes, gathering her thoughts, getting her story together. Slipping out of the dressing gown she'd worn back from the spa, she pulled on a sweater and jeans and tied back her hair. She decided against putting on makeup, wanting to look pale and distressed. She took the lift down 3 floors and walked towards the reception desk. As she approached, she saw a young, fair-haired man standing by it, dressed in a blue fleece jacket, with the word Gendarmerie in white across the back of it. The receptionist, to whom she had spoken several times during their short stay, was holding a phone in her hand and replaced it as she saw Jody.
"Ah, Mademoiselle Bentley," she said, looking uneasy. "I was just calling your room."
She pointed to the police officer.
"This is Christophe Schmiel from the Courchevel Gendarmerie. He wishes to have a word with you."
What about?"
She turned to the policeman, feeling a genuine prickle of anxiety. He gave her a concerned smile and spoke in good English.
"Mademoiselle Bentley, is it possible, please, I have a private word with you?"
"Yes. Yes, of course. Is this about my fiancé, Walt? I'm really worried about him. We got separated skiing this morning up at the top in the whiteout, and I've not seen him all day. Please, tell me nothing's happened to him. I've been waiting all afternoon for some news. I'm at my wit's end."
The receptionist spoke to the officer in French.
"Voulez-vous utiliser notre bureau?"
"Oui, bien, merci," he replied. The receptionist led them behind the counter into a small office with 2 computer screens, several filing cabinets, and 2 swivel chairs. Then she closed the door behind them. The police officer gestured to one of the chairs and, Looking as weak and anxious as she could, Jodie sat down.
"Please tell me what's safe, isn't he?" she asked.
He pulled out a small notepad and looked at it briefly. "Mademoiselle Bentley, is your fiancé's name Walt Klein?"
"Yes, it is."
"And you last saw him at what time today?" She shrugged.
"About 10 o'clock this morning. We took the cable car up to the top of the Solier. The visibility was terrible, but he was keen for us to be up early to get the fresh powder before it was skied out."
He gave her a dubious look. "You are both good skiers?"
"Yes, he's better than I am. He's an expert. I'm a bit nervous because I don't know this resort very well yet, but we were told the weather was improving. We couldn't see a damn thing at the top, but there were some other skiers who were in the cable car with us. I saw them ski off and thought the best thing would be to follow them. Walt told me to go first in case I fell and he could help me, so I set off, trying to keep up with the others, but they shot off ahead of me, going too quickly. I stopped and waited for Walt, but he never appeared. Do you know where he is? I've been terrified he's had an accident. Please tell me he's all right."
She began crying. Schmiel waited for her to compose herself. "We are just trying to establish exactly what has happened," he said, then asked, "What did you do when your fiancé did not appear?"
"We'd agreed to phone each other, and if we couldn't get through, we'd head down to the Croisette and wait for each other there, and in a worse case, we'd come back to the hotel and meet here. Then I realized that, stupidly, I'd not brought my phone, so I skied on down to the Croisette."
She sniffed and dabbed her eyes. "And you waited for him?"
"I waited an hour."
"And you weren't concerned?"
"Not at that point, no. It's pretty easy to lose someone in a whiteout, and he and I come from rather different skiing cultures."
"Cultures?" She took some moments to compose herself.
"I'm so worried about him. He's always skied in places like Park City and Aspen, American resorts, where they have powder all the time. I don't like skiing in zero visibility, but it didn't bother him, so long as there was fresh powder. He knew I hadn't been that keen to go out today, so I figured he'd found himself some great virgin snow, and reckoned I'd be just as happy to come back here and enjoy the pool and have a massage."
The officer nodded. "Mademoiselle Bentley, I am very afraid to tell you, but this afternoon a body was found at the bottom of the sheer side of the Solier."
"Oh, God, no!" she cried out. "No, please, no. Please, no, no, no. Tell me. It's not Walt. Please, tell me."
"This face? This is not possible to ski. Not even for off-piste experts. It is only used by the paragliders. The identification we have is two credit cards and the gentleman's ski lift pass. It is looking to us as if he must have perhaps mistaken the tracks. The name on the credit cards is Walter Klein. The ski lift pass was issued by this hotel."
"Can you describe him?" she asked,
tears rolling down her cheeks. "I have not myself seen him yet. I am told he's a gentleman perhaps in his 70s, with white hair, quite tall, and a little heavy build." He looked at her quizzically. She began sobbing.
"Oh, God! Oh, God! Oh, God, no!"
"I'm sorry to ask you this, but would you come with me to Moutier to identify the body?" She crumpled, burying her face in her arms. After some moments she fell silent, wary of overdoing it. Chapter 5. Tuesday, the 10th of February. Roy Grace had been hoping to get home early in time to help Cleo bath Noah and put him to bed with his favourite picture book story. Instead, he had been chained to his desk all day with Glenn Branson, exchanging phone calls and emails with an English-speaking police officer, Bernard Viguet, in the Lyon, France, office of Interpol. On his desk in front of him lay the email Glenn had brought in earlier that had come from an officer in the Lyon Gendarmerie addressed to the senior investigating officer of Operation Haywayne, the continuing inquiry into the missing suspected serial killer, Dr. Edward Crisp. It stated that a sex worker in the city had gone missing 2 days ago after being seen getting into a car late at night in the red light district. A fellow prostitute, who had been shy to come forward at first, had raised the alarm. She had caught a glimpse of the man in the car, and he resembled the image of Crisp that Grace had circulated through Interpol. The colleague had given a description of the car and the part of its registration plate that she could recall. It matched a rental car that had been hired from Hertz and subsequently returned by an Englishman called Tony Souter. Something that had piqued Grace's interest was that Tony Souter was one of the numerous aliases that Crisp had used in past years. Of course, it could have been coincidence. What could also have been coincidence was the appearance of the sex worker. She was in her early 20s, with long brown hair. The exact profile of every single one of Crisp's known female victims to date. The car had been valeted and already gone out with another customer. The French police were now urgently looking for it. In response to Roy Grace's confirmation that this could indeed be his suspect, they were currently in the process of obtaining the CCTV footage from the rental company's premises, and a manhunt was underway for the young woman.
A big place, Leon.
I've been there.
One of the largest metropolitan areas in France, Branson said helpfully.
Thanks for the geography lesson.
You're welcome. Here's one for you. The French Connection, with Gene Hackman. Remember that?
Yes, why?
That was partly set in Marseille, the second largest city.
What's that got to do with anything?
Nothing. Just trying to use any opportunity to educate you. And it had a great ending.
You trying to tell me something? Branson was hesitant suddenly.
Oh, yeah, right, he said. I forgot. Maybe not so tactful.
You could say that, Grace said, unless you're trying to give me some kind of message. Branson grinned, then raised his hands submissively.
No message.
I'm glad about that, because the bad guy got away.
Chapter 6. Tuesday, the 17th of February. After a week of hanging around, dealing with French officialdom, before Walt Klein's body was finally released after the post-mortem, Jody accompanied her fiancé back to New York. She travelled up at the pointed end, sipping vintage bubbly in first class, appearing to the cabin crew every inch a grieving lover, consoling herself with alcohol. Walt travelled in less style, in the rear cargo hold of the plane. Although, to be fair, she reasoned at one point, drifting off into a pleasant doze, he had more legroom in his coffin than those poor bastards back in economy. And also, to be fair, she had not scrimped on the coffin. It was a top-of-the-range, hand-carved rosewood affair, with a satin taffeta border and genuine brass handles. There was no finer coffin to be had anywhere in the Alps, the undertaker in Moutier had assured her. And certainly, when she saw the price, none that could possibly have been more expensive. That would have been fine by her late fiancé, had he been in a position to help with the decision. Walt was dismissive of bargains.
"You buy cheap, you buy twice," he had told her on more than one occasion.
He'd have been proud of just how expensive this beauty had been, she thought. His final little treat to himself. She would present the bill to his lawyer, who would reimburse her. The champagne she had been quaffing throughout the journey from her constantly topped-up glass was still in her system, maintaining her pleasantly woozy haze through the lengthy immigration queue. Although she hoped she did not reek too much of alcohol when, questioned by the immigration officer at passport control as to the reason for her visit, she had replied, trying to look and sound suitably grief-stricken, "To bury my fiancé." She collected her bags and entered the arrivals hall, then instantly felt in need of another top-up of alcohol when she saw the frosty faces of Walt's two children. Don, his tall, serious 40-year-old son, and Carla, his softer, warmer 35-year-old daughter, who had come to the airport more out of respect for their deceased father than any love for their gold-digger of a potential stepmother.
"Carla," Jody said, throwing her arms around her, "oh my God, this is so terrible, so terrible."
She burst into tears.
"Dad was an expert skier," Don said dryly. "He's skied off-piste for years. He wouldn't make a mistake."
"It was a whiteout. In a blizzard," Jody sobbed. "We couldn't see our hands in front of our faces."
"Dad wouldn't have made a mistake," he repeated.
"We're staying at Dad's apartment until the funeral," Carla said. "Hope that's okay with you."
"But as we figured you might want to be alone, to grieve for our father, and avoid all the hassle from the press, we took the precaution of booking you into a hotel," Don said. "Your choice."
Suddenly, she heard a male voice call out, "Jody!" She turned, saw the strobe of a flash gun, and heard the whir of a camera motor. Another voice called her name, and, as she glanced to the right, another flash gun went, then another. There were a dozen paparazzi lined up, all now shouting her name.
"Jody, did you know about Walt? How much did you know about Walt's finances?"
Jody had met Walt in Las Vegas just over 6 months earlier. He'd been sitting at a table on his own in a smoking bar at the Bellagio, drinking a martini and lighting a cigar. She'd sat a few tables away, smoking a cigarette and drinking a margarita, eyeing potentials. This was one of the city's most expensive hotels. People who stayed here, or even just came in for a drink, were likely to be reasonably well off at worst, seriously loaded at best. She'd travelled from Brighton, arriving the day before, to have a break, play some blackjack at the high-stakes tables, and try to find a new man. Her kind of man. A nice, lonely, elderly man. Someone who would be grateful for her attentions. But most importantly of all, someone rich. Very rich. This trip was an investment, just like her profiles on the high-end dating agencies were. She chose blackjack because it was sociable. You got a chance to talk to your fellow gamblers, and there was a steady turnover of players. She'd made a study of it, read books, and knew all the tricks of the game. There was no strategy that could guarantee winning, but there was one that enabled her to stay at a high rollers table for hours on end, losing very little money. A small cost for the opportunities it gave her to size up the men who perched beside her at the table. And you could get married in this city, with no fuss at all, any time from 8 a.m. to midnight, on any day. It looked like she was getting lucky sooner on this trip than she had expected. The jackpot on day one. A little overweight and flabby, in his mid-70s, she guessed, with a thick head of wavy silver hair, he was dressed in a yellow Gucci cardigan over a shirt with gold buttons and blue suede Todd's loafers. He looked lonely and sad and had no wedding ring on his finger. Hunched up over the table, he was peering at his phone, reading something. Wall Street prices? After a while, he put it down, ate the olive from his martini, then drained the drink and signalled to a waiter for another. Then he puffed on his cigar, a Cohiba, she could tell from the yellow and black band. She stared at him, holding her cigarette between her fingers, the smoke rising. It took some moments before he finally looked up and caught her eye. She smiled. He gave her a brief, slightly embarrassed nod of acknowledgement, blinked his heavy-lidded eyes, then made a play of looking back down at his phone and tapping the keys, as if to show he wasn't any kind of Billy No-Mates, but a busy man. Instantly, she made her move, crushing out her cigarette, scooping up her glass and her bag. Then she strode across to his table in her silky Ted Baker dress and red Jimmy Choo's and sat down opposite him. Putting on her poshest, cut-glass English accent, she said, "You look as lonely as I feel."
"That's so?"
He lifted his eyes from his phone and gave her a melancholic stare. She raised her glass.
"Cheers."
Obligingly, at that moment, the waiter produced a fresh martini for him. He raised it, and they clinked glasses.
"Cheers,"
he said back to her, a little hesitant, as if unsure whether he'd just been hit on by a hooker.
"Jody Bentley," she said. "I'm from Brighton, England."
"Walt Klein."
He set his glass down and folded his arms. Mirroring him, deliberately, she set her glass down and folded her arms too.
"So, what brings you to Vegas?" she asked.
"You want the trailer, or the full 3 hours with intermission?"
She laughed.
"I don't have a train to catch. So long as there's ice cream, popcorn, and alcohol involved, the intermission version is fine by me."
He grinned.
"Yeah, well, right. I'm here to try to forget for a while."
He opened his arms and placed his hands either side of his thighs. Instantly, but subtly, she did the same.
"Forget?"
"I went through a pretty bad divorce. Married 44 years.
He shrugged, and his heavy eyelids lowered, like theatre curtains, then raised again. Once more she mirrored him.
44 years? You don't look old enough. Married in your teens, did you?"
"Very flattering of you. I'm probably a bit older than you think. What do you reckon?
55?
You're being too kind. Hey, I like your accent. Love the British accent.
Well, thank you,
she said, exaggerating it even more.
Okay, 57?
Try 77.
No way.
Uh-huh.
You look 20 years younger. You must take good care of yourself.
He held up the cigar, then nodded at his martini. These things take good care of me. Only kidding. Yep, I work out daily, play tennis regularly, and I like to ski in winter.
I like to keep fit, too, she said. I belong to a health club back home, and I ski whenever I can. Where do you like to go?
Mostly Aspen. Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and Park City in Utah.
No kidding. Those are resorts I've always wanted to go to, particularly Aspen.
She opened her handbag and pulled out her cigarettes, took one out, and held it up, mirroring him again. You know the place I'd really like to go to is Courchevel in France.
It's the best skiing in the world, she said.
You know it, do you?
Really well.
So maybe I should take you there.
Tonight?
He raised his eyebrows. If you want.
He looked at his watch.
Okay, so it's 8:30. France is, if I'm working it out right, 9 hours ahead of us, so 5:30 in the morning. If I chartered a jet now, we could be there in time for dinner tomorrow night.
There's just one problem, she said.
Which is?
There's no snow there right now. It's August.
Good point.
How about a nice dinner here instead, she suggested.
That would mean cancelling my dinner plans, he said.
Which were?
There was a famous gourmet in your country back in the 1950s, way before you were born, a multi-millionaire Armenian called Nubar Gulbenkian. He once said, "The best number for dinner is 2, myself and a good waiter."
I'm not sure I would totally agree. She gave him a mischievous look. So you were going to have dinner with yourself?
Yep.
I waited tables once, she said, when I was a student.
You did?
It didn't last very long. I poured someone's very expensive wine into a water glass by mistake, and it still had water in it.
He laughed. Hope they didn't take it from your wages.
Luckily not, but they fired me.
She smiled.
So, she asked, your divorce, what happened?
Walt Klein looked sheepish. Well, after my divorce, I married my second wife, Karen, who was much younger than me. I thought we had a good relationship and that we'd be together forever. My kids and my 5 grandkids adored her. And one day, I guess about 2 years back, she suddenly said to me in a restaurant, "You make me feel old." He shrugged. That was kind of it. She told me she wanted a divorce. I asked her if there was anyone else, and she denied it.
And was there?
She was into art and had been bored for some while. I'd bought her an art gallery down in the West Village. I heard through a friend she was screwing a sculptor whose work she was exhibiting.
I'm sorry, Jody said.
Shit happens.
It does.
So, what's your story?
Do you want the trailer or the full 3 hours with intermission?
He laughed. Give me the trailer now, then the full 3 hours over dinner.
Okay. She gave him a wan smile. I was married to a wife beater.
Oh, that's terrible. Poor you.
It was. It's been a nightmare. Total nightmare. I'm not sure I could ever trust a man again.
You want to start from the beginning?
Jody nodded. Sure, if you don't mind listening.
I have all evening, he said. Another drink?
Yes, thank you, she said, seeing the way he was looking at her, knowing she already had him in the palm of her hand. She made an excuse that she had to visit the ladies. Locked in a cubicle there, she googled Walt Klein.
He was a stockbroker, investment advisor, and financier with a Wall Street securities company bearing his name and an estimated $8 billion under management. Smiling happily, she slipped her phone back into her handbag and went back out.
Walt Klein would do very nicely. Very nicely indeed.
Chapter 7. The Past. Jodie Danforth had a ton of homework to do, but she wasn't able to concentrate. Instead, she sat cross-legged on her bed, barefoot in jeans and a Blur t-shirt, holding her diary in her hand, sobbing, in her perfectly untidy bedroom upstairs in her parents' perfect house. It was a square, white-painted mock Georgian villa with green shutters, set in an immaculate garden, still bathed in late-evening May sunlight, in a tree-lined street of almost identical houses on the outskirts of Burgess Hill, a town a few miles to the north of Brighton. Everything was always in its place. Her mother cleaned the house obsessively. Her father cleaned their cars obsessively and proudly. Out at the front on the drive sat her father's immaculate new black Jaguar and her mother's Saab convertible. Perfect parents, with one perfect daughter, her elder sister Cassie, and one big embarrassment. Their problem daughter. Herself. Posters of Jodie's icons were on her bedroom walls. Madonna, Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise, Kylie Minogue, Take That, Blur and Oasis. All of them perfect too. With perfect noses. Unlike her own. Through her tears, she wrote in her diary.
Everywhere I go, people are pointing at me and laughing, because I'm so ugly, telling me I'm a freak. My nose is ridiculous. I watch my reflection in the window of the bus taking me to school this morning. It's not a nose. It's a great big hooked beak, a snozzle, a snout. Some bitch left a picture of the aeroplane Concorde on my desk this morning, with a post-it note attached, on which she had written that my nose was like the front of the plane, hooked and dipped. My eyes are too big also. When I look in the mirror, they're all swollen, and it's not just from crying. They're too big for my face. Fact. And my lips are too fat, like someone's punched me in the mouth and made them swell up. And my ears are too big. It's like someone put my face together using all the wrong parts, like they took them from the wrong box. And my breasts are ridiculous. I'm flat. I've got a chest like a boy's. Cassie's, of course, are perfectly formed. Earlier in the day, in the English class, everyone had to stand up and read aloud to the class a Shakespeare sonnet they'd chosen. Trudy Byrne read one out, staring pointedly at me all the time. My mistress' eyes are nothing like the sun. Coral is far more red than her lips red. If snow be white, why then her breasts are dun. If hairs be wires, black wires grow on her head. I have seen roses damasked red and white, but no such roses see I in her cheeks. And in some perfumes is there more delight than in the breath that from my mistress reeks, and so on. So bloody on. It's true. My hair is like a bunch of black wires. They sprout all over my head like pubes or a scouring pad. Why don't I have the same blonde straight hair that my bloody sister Cassie has? I've just been dealt a really shitty hand. Dad dotes on Cassie. She's always playing around and joking with him, but when he looks at me I can see the disappointment in his face, like I'm not really his daughter at all. Not the second daughter he always promised himself. Not much of a substitute for the son he was really hankering for. And if he couldn't have had a son, at least he could have had a second stunner of a daughter. Instead he got me. Mum and Dad are arguing again downstairs. I can hear their voices above the sound of the television. Dad's angry because he's worried about losing his job. They're making a lot of redundancies in his company, although Mum assures him he's too important. They could never let him go. Sounds like he's been drinking again. That's not unusual. He gets drunk most nights. He's worried about money, about the mortgage payments on this house, the finance on the fancy cars. But at 50 he's over the hill and might never get another job.
Jodie heard a slam. The front door. Often when her parents argued, her father went out and down to the pub.
She listened for the sound of his car starting, but heard nothing. Maybe he was being sensible for once and walking. She opened her bedroom door to listen and could hear music coming from her sister's room. She could talk to her mother. She wanted right now to curl up on the sofa in her mother's arms and maybe watch some television with her. Her mother was the only person who ever told her she was beautiful, even though Jodie knew that was a lie. The television was on, loudly, an American couple shouting at each other. She made her way downstairs, then stopped shortly before the bottom as she heard another slam. Her father coming back in?
"That bloody cat!" he shouted. "Why can't it shit in its own garden?"
He looked up at Jodie coming down the stairs, as if it was her fault. She stared back at him as he stormed into the living room. Her mother said something Jodie could not hear above the din of the television. It sounded like she was trying to pacify him.
"How great is that? All I've got in the world is a neighbour's sodding cat that uses our garden as a toilet, a wife who drives me to drink, and one daughter who's a total nightmare."
The television was suddenly muted, and she could hear both their voices clearly.
"You've got to realise she's going through a difficult time of life," her mother said. "Mid-teens is hard for girls."
"Bollocks. Cassie was never like this."
"Shh! Keep your voice down. You dote on Cassie because she's pretty. Jodie can't help her looks. She'll blossom in a couple of years."
"It's not just her looks. It's her attitude. She's a miserable little cow."
"Maybe she'd be less miserable if you tried a little harder with her."
"I have tried. If I give her a hug, she shrinks away like some slippery reptile, which she is. Alistair,
that's no way to speak about your daughter."
"If she is my daughter."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"She doesn't look like you, and she sure as hell doesn't look like me. So who are you shagging to get pregnant with her? Someone from a travelling circus freak show?"
Jodie heard a thud like a slap, followed by a howl of pain from her father.
"You bitch!" he shouted.
"Don't ever speak about our daughter like that. Do you hear me?
She's a freak, and you know it. Hit me again, and I'll tear your bloody head off."
"Take it back, or I will hit you again, you bastard. Jesus, what did I ever see in you to marry you?"
"She's an embarrassment. She's fat, she's ugly, and she's got an ugly mind. If she was something I'd bought in Poundland, I'd take her back and demand a replacement. Too bad we can't."
"Alistair, I'm warning you. She's already got a complex, poor kid, always living in her sister's shadow, and whose fault is that? Yes, we both know she's got unfortunate looks. Give it a couple of years, I really do think she'll blossom."
"See that, out of the window?" her father said.
"See what?"
"That pig out there, flying across the horizon. That pig's prettier than our daughter."
Chapter 8. Tuesday, the 17th of February. The little squirrel monkey, astride the slender branch of a tree, stared at them through the window of the enclosure at Drusilla's zoo. Its coat was a patchwork of grey, ginger and white, and it had sad, inquisitive eyes. Suddenly it began gnawing a chunk of carrot it was holding in its front paws. Noah, who had been staring back at it wide-eyed, as if unsure what to make of the creature, suddenly giggled. It was a fine day, unseasonably warm. "Like the monkey, do you?" Roy Grace said to his son, who was cradled in front of his chest in a baby sling. "Want monkeys on your wallpaper? Or a monkey mobile?" Noah beamed and dribbled. Then, as the monkey continued eating, he chuckled, dribbling some more. God, it was the most beautiful thing to hear his son laughing, Grace thought, wiping Noah's chin with a tissue. Then, peering down, he made monkey faces and noises at his son. Noah giggled again. Roy Grace grinned and put his arm round Cleo, who leaned into him. He was taking a precious day off work to be with his loved ones, and wished he did this more often. He was able to, he knew. He had so many days of accrued leave owing to him. Yet he couldn't help feeling a slight cloud of guilt, having already had all of January off. He remembered a quote from somewhere.